Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Here in this primitive river bottom wilderness in southern Arkansas, along with deer, duck, crane, and beaver, lurks a creature that walks upright. Whether it is a man, a monster, or a myth, no one really knows. What we do know is the people around Fauk, Arkansas, say they have seen such a creature nearly 250 times since 1954. And that this creature, whatever it is, emits one of the most terrifying sounds ever recorded. Boggy Creek, rated G.
Welcome back to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me here in the wilds of northern Michigan is Rob St. Mary.
Yeah, I like you, Mike, but can you get your own sleeping bag?
It's a cost-cutting measure. I mean, we don't really have sponsors for this show. And plus, I love the way you cuddle. Somewhere away from base camp is Dave Coleman.
Hey, guys. Am I there? Hello?
We can hear you, Dave.
Yeah, I'm kind of losing you a little bit. Sorry. Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. You know, Dave, I sent up a flare of just a few minutes ago. I'll send up another one in 10 minutes. I was hoping we could record the entire episode around the campfire, but, you know, kind of make this more of an intimate affair. But at least you've got your walkie-talkie so we can still record. You know, I thought maybe you would have taken a pee break a little bit earlier. So let's get on into this. This week we're talking about the legend of Boggy Creek, one of the touchstones of the Ciné du Sasquatch. That's a term that Dave coined in his remarkable book, The Bigfoot Filmography. And if you haven't seen this, it is an amazing collection of all things Bigfoot. We will talk a little bit more about that, but first let's get into the legend of Boggy Creek. It is what can you call it? It's kind of a docudrama from 1972 about the folk monster, F-O-U-K-E, I'm so tempted to mispronounce that, of Arkansas. It mixes narrative vignettes of the beast terrorizing unsuspecting folks and kind of this quasi-documentary stuff of locals and their encounters with the creature. Now, Dave, I'd be tempted to call the folk monster a Bigfoot, but really, when they talk about the odor and all, it sounds like the creature is more of a skunk ape, I guess. So how would one differentiate between different beasties that populate the wild?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I it's interesting because I think the skunk ape is kind of a derivation, if you will, of Bigfoot. You know, Bigfoot kind of was... You know, I like to think of it like Bigfoot films really in... were like the next level after Yeti films, because, you know, you got these movies like that were really great in the genre, like The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas from Hammer with Peter Cushing. And these movies were great, but they were always about Yetis, you know, and it was always removed in the Himalayas. And then, you know, after Patterson came along and made the Roger Patterson film, whether you believe it, it's real or not, the film itself kind of made all of that move to North America, but it was still in the Pacific Northwest, which is where I think most people... I mean, I'm going to get cryptozoologists emailing me now, but that most people, you know, associate Bigfoot with the Pacific Northwest region. That's where a lot of the popular press reportings out of Oregon and Washington, California came out of initially. So that moniker kind of stuck there. And I think it's further that it's associated more with the Pacific Northwest and the mountains. There is like one thing I know your question brings to mind, because it's stressed in The Legend of Boggy Creek, interestingly enough, is that the skunk ape, besides preferring, you know, seemingly like bayous and boggy marshes and marshlands and things, like in Florida, it's always in that kind of area as well when it's called a skunk ape. It also has typically, at least in these Falk, Arkansas sightings, it has a three-toe instead of a five-toe, which most of the Bigfoot casts have. They tend to follow much more like a primate foot extended out. And so it does have, like, skunk apes do have local anomalies that make them a little different. But I think, you know, basically they're all hairy wild men of the woods, the rivers, the lakes. They're all pretty much the same. It's just that the reportings can vary region to region.
I would guess that a Yeti and an abominable snowman are pretty much one and the same, right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, I mean, really, if you, I like to look at it from a Western or North American perspective because I'm lazy, and it makes it easier. But seriously, I mean, you know, I look at it like a Westerner, like an American, and where would I have heard of it first? And the real truth is, until, you know, the 1950s and the expeditions in the Himalayas that were reporting footprints by, like, Sir Edmund Hillary and people who were renowned, they weren't fakers by nature, who were bringing back reports of Yetis, really sparked it in the 50s, and that's the real modern birth of it in the films as well. I mean, I cite in the book earlier examples that kind of predate the genre and influence it, but Bigfoot movies really kind of start in the 50s with the Yeti films, you know, and that's where most Americans kind of get their frame of reference to it as well, as the headlines. And, you know, and that's the way it stayed up until the time Patterson really kind of, his movie broke through. Roger Patterson in 1967 did, you know, the famous Bigfoot footage of about a minute and a half of a guy, or a real Bigfoot, depending on your point of view, walking, you know, along a creek bed in California. And that became, like, you know, that suddenly reoriented all of the interest back to America from the Himalayas. You know, it was like, suddenly it was an American phenomenon instead of it being just something that was removed. And I think that was a big leap forward in it, you know, so to speak. And, you know, the next part of it that came, I think, is kind of like the next deviation, I guess, would be Sasquatch, kind of the friendly Bigfoot movies that kind of came out of later, Harry and the Hendersons. That's kind of like the three, you know, branches of it that have evolved so far in the genre that are real distinct. I mean, there's a lot of subgenres in it too, you know, like bestiality Bigfoot movies, and just it goes on and on. It's a strange genre because it's got so many different kinds of movies that kind of constitute it as a genre, really.
You talk about that, like, Carl Denham character so often, and then, yeah, there's like the way that people kind of project onto the Bigfoot these different things, like the benevolent protector of the forest, yeah, or the sex hungry other who's looking to bed the women and everything. And yeah, it's strange how it is so many things to so many different people. Do you think that more people have seen the Patterson footage or the Zapruder film?
I mean, that's a really great question, seriously. I mean, that's a great question. It cuts right at all the things I'm interested in culture and sociology and mythology and popular folklore and movies. And the answer, after that long-winded wind-up, is, I mean, I don't even know how you would calculate that, but you get right at what is the Patterson's film's, like, legacy, which is it's the focal point of almost all of the debate that spins out of it in the culture and the community. And it's almost prior to that, although people made skeptical claims against it, it didn't get as divisive, and it's almost like America now, it's just polarized in the communities. Even you see this, like, I mean, just not even long ago there was this whole thing about to kill a Bigfoot or not kill a Bigfoot, you know, in Texas, Texas Bigfoot kill policy, where they, hunters said they would shoot a Bigfoot if they needed to gather a specimen to prove to skeptics and the scientific value. And, you know, that's the Carl Denham syndrome you mentioned, actually. Carl Denham, you know, is, of course, the archetype character in King Kong, who, we're going to go make a picture and, you know, damn with it all, you know, exploit whatever's there, and kind of takes it back to the world and exploits it and for a profit. And, you know, he says at the end, it was beauty to kill the beast. I'm like, I don't know, man. The bottom line had something to do with it too, Carl. You know, it wasn't just the beauty. It was the fact that you chain the beast and bring it back and exploit it. You know, and that character's very germane to many Bigfoot films. I mean, you see it all the time with the cliche hunter who's got to have it, on, you know, on my wall. I'm going to have his head on my wall. But it's a lot more subtle than that, and runs through the genre, and some of the better films almost always have, like, these kind of archetypal encounters between a human who wants to exploit either the environment the Bigfoot lives in or wants to kill a Bigfoot and exploit him or her or whatever, you know. And it's kind of like so pervasive that it becomes almost monotonous. I in the book, writing about it, it kind of was like, gosh, not another one that's like that. But it's just an underlying motif that if you start watching them all back to back, I mean, it's kind of like a zombie movie. You know that you shoot them in the head, it kills them, and they're going to eat flesh and eat brains. And it's all evolved like that in the Bigfoot genre, too. It's got its own set of rules and, you know, kind of defining characters and motifs, and it's all there. And almost all of them, whether I don't know if they're aware of it or not, but they almost all seem to, excuse the pun, ape those kind of classic archetypes. And that's where I'm really interested in. You know, that's why you say, like, the Zapruder film, that's exactly what the Patterson film is. It's a leaping off point for the popular imagination. There's the dry academics, maybe like myself, somewhat, who would say, well, you know, of course it was one person and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, then there may be the more speculative people who would say, you know, well, I mean, it pretty obviously shows, like, you know, was it Oliver Stone back and forward, you know, in the Oliver Stone JFK movie where he's showing the Zapruder film. It's really horrifying to just sit there and watch those frames over and over that way. And it does create an outrage in you that makes you want to act, you know. And so, and I think the Patterson film does that. For believers, man, it's proof positive that, you know, there can be no doubt. And then for people who are skeptics, it's just the opposite. It's proof that, you know, people will do anything to fake a Bigfoot, whether it's real or not. So it's very interesting kind of dynamic. Sorry I went off on that, but you really struck a chord with that.
Well, speaking of Legend of Boggy Creek, how does that sort of fit into the overall sort of arc of the various Sasquatch-themed films, and sort of what have you learned about the creation of it?
Well, that's another good question, because, you know, I had no idea going into writing the book that there were touchstone Bigfoot movies, let's call them, for a lot of people of all generations, starting with the boomer generation, who I would typify with Lauren Coleman. He's no relation, but, you know, he's a noted cryptozoologist. He's written like 20-something books on various Bigfoot and 40 and subjects, so he's considered an authority on the subject. And he cites in the introduction of the book how Half Human, this, you know, Toho Studios movie, really just, I mean, it just changed his life. It made him want to become a cryptozoologist. And lo and behold, you know, however many years later, 50 years later, he still is, and now one of the renowned ones. And, okay, well, there's not many other films like that, again, that inspire cryptozoologists, I found out researching the book, until Legend of Boggy Creek, and suddenly there's the Generation X, or late-age boomers, whatever you want to typify them as sociologically, people who are, you know, growing up in the 70s as impressionable kids who saw it, and it made a huge wave on the people who saw it in that era, in that setting, in that time frame, you know. And then later, much less so, Harry and the Hendersons brought a kind of an intrigue to kind of a later generation that's much more affectionate towards Bigfoot, you know, benign Bigfoot versus savage Sasquatch is what I say in the book, you know. And it's kind of true. It can be real black and white. Bigfoot can be like Mr. Friendly, you know, help the kids who are lost. And then, you know, in the next movie, he's just ripping everybody apart, you know, and there's no rhyme nor reason. It would be like if Dracula was a really nice guy in one movie and helping out the lost villagers to a meal and getting them on their way, you know, before sunset. And then in the next movie, he's feasting on them. And it's really kind of crazy that way as a genre. I think it shows, like, you know, the interest in it is kind of really universal and deep, and people want to supply their own meanings to it. You know, they don't want your Bigfoot, they want theirs. My Bigfoot will rip your ass up. But, you know, then my Bigfoot is the protector of Mother Nature. And there is a lot of that in both the believer community and the fans of the movies communities. You know, Little Bigfoot does still sell copies, even if it's hard to believe, for families to watch. And, you know, for people who like a more pacifist version of Bigfoot, they don't want to see him kind of like the Jaws character, you know, the shark. They don't want to see him as an eating machine. They want to see him as an intelligent, you know, benign being who may have to defend himself, but, you know, he doesn't really want to attack you.
He's more like Jabberjaws from the Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. There's a Jabberjaws quality to a lot of that Filmation Bigfoot stuff that's in the book, too, you know. I mean, it's amazing how, like, just prostituted Bigfoot is in the culture. You know, that's one of the reasons why in the book it says the Bigfoot filmography, and I suppose if there's a little bit more of truth in advertising, or disclaimer that, you know, you'd say that it's more than that too. I tried to cover the commercials that, like, obviously the Jack's Beef Link, you know, the beef jerky ads and others too, because what was fascinating to me, like, when I started researching it, because I had, you know, I mean, I no one had ever really written about this before, which is another thing I found out was really odd. I kept expecting I was going to stumble across, you know, an earlier book written about this subject matter, and I never found it, you know. And so watching the movies, I started noticing how they influence the culture at the time that they're made, such that they migrate out into the commercials of the era, and you see it, and you see it in the commercials. And so I wanted to document that as a kind of same way I actually, you know, in the book, I also put in a lot of documentaries. I mean, again, you know, some people would call them pseudo documentaries if they're skeptics, of course, or just outright procumentaries is another name, you know, and there are some of those too. But it's interesting that, you know, the movies are so much a reflection of the audiences that watch them, and the audiences are very different in some ways, very different.
Well, what I liked was that Boggy Creek kind of mixed the documentary with the narrative film, you know. And but I want to know, what kind of stuff did you uncover about Charles B. Pierce, the filmmaker? Because he seems like a fascinating dude.
I ran Bijou Flicks, or Bijou Cafe, an independent cult film distribution company, a kind of a micro distributor throughout the 90s and some of the, you know, years after there. And I got a chance to actually get to know Mr. Charlie is what he called himself a lot of times, and his friends called him Mr. Charlie. I got a chance to know him a little bit via phone, some conversations and some emails we exchanged. I was actually trying to interest him, no joke, in remaking The Legend of Boggy Creek. I had some minor funds from some people who would be interested, but they wanted to get a young director and a young cast, and they wanted to control it, and Charlie just, you know, wouldn't give it up. And I didn't blame him. I said, look, I don't blame you. It's your baby. Well, if, you know, you don't trust that, you know, we could put together something that was good, I wouldn't do it either, you know. So I totally respected him for that, but was disappointed, of course. You know, and he's a guy, I mean, you know, so little is known about him. It's a crime. I mean, the guy worked, like, as a set decorator on over 50-something credits on television, going back from, like, Remington Steele, MacGyver. He worked on the new Twilight Zone. He worked on features like Scream, Blackula, Scream, Black Belt Jones, Pre-Made All in a Row. He was, like, you know, a big contributor creatively to all those films and TV shows for all those years while he was still making independent features. And, you know, I mean, as a director, like, barely half of his catalog is even easily available on DVD. Town That Dreaded Sundown is. I think The Evictors is now. But, I mean, a lot of his stuff is still not available. Chasing the Wind, Gray Eagle, I mean, Winter Hawk, Sacred Ground. These are all feature films that he did that have, you know, relatively big name casts. Some of them, you know, Peter Fonda, and obviously Ben Johnson's in a lot of them, and a lot of the regulars he used, and yet they're unknown. And I listen, this is the part of it that I don't really know much about Charlie beyond speculation, but, you know, at one point he was so successful with these movies. You know, Legend of Boggy Creek grossed approximately $22 million in 1972 dollars for Wall, when tickets for that movie were probably 75 cents to a dollar on average. Okay, so that movie was huge, and, you know, he used a lot of the windfall profits, from what I was told by an associate of his when I was talking to him and getting to know him, to build a kind of a little mini fiefdom empire down there in Louisiana somewhere, where he had, like, a private landing strip with a plane that had the pontoons on it, so he could go up into the bayou into his mansion, and he had, like, collectible cars, and he was like a little mini mogul there, and yet he was still doing all the Hollywood stuff in between all that, you know. And I think eventually, I'm not sure, that he had some gambling problems or something of a personal debt nature. And I'm not trying to speculate negatively on the man's character at all. I'm trying to just say that at some point something happened, and I believe that part of the rights to the catalog and his library got lost, or just not properly protected at that point. And that part of it, well, he was a very, what do they say in network, crusty but benign. You know, Charlie, when I got to know him, was the latter years of his life, he was pretty hard-headed and pretty certain of what he wanted and stuff. So a lot of times when you would ask him questions like that, you'd never get a straight answer, really, per se. You'd get kind of a tangent, and I'd never quite know where I stood on that, in that level. So I'm not sure about the rights on a lot of these movies. You know, I know he had retained them, and some of them hadn't been released. I was actually going to try to help broker a deal with them overseas at some film festivals to help license some of them, but that never worked out, because he couldn't provide chain of document titles and things that are legally necessary at some points. And so I just don't know. I mean, I know that, like, the Library of Congress has Legend of Boggy Creek now. On, you know, you have it on your projection booth page, the link to the Internet Archives, where you can see it for free as a supposedly public domain film. I suspect that legally it is. I think it's a situation where the rights were never very clearly established, and so it lapsed into public domain.
During your time talking to Charlie Pierce, did he ever mention Clint Eastwood? Because on, you know, of course, yeah, the Internet's never wrong, said he did set decoration on Outlaw Josey Wales and then helped to write Sudden Impact and actually wrote that famous line, "Go ahead, make
Absolutely.
My day."
Listen, yeah, he was so proud of that, and I'm terrible. I would let him tell the story again and again just because I liked hearing it. I mean, that was a crowning achievement for him because, you know, clearly Eastwood was a major, you know, he was a fan, obviously, and clearly he had been his ear to get him to even look at the story. I mean, it's rewritten completely. He only gets story credit on the final Sudden Impact movie. But, I mean, you know, he wrote that line, and I would argue that without that line, that movie probably wouldn't be memorable as an Eastwood picture, largely. I like Eastwood, but that's not one of his strongest films by any means, you know. That line, though, makes it one of the great moments in the Dirty Harry series. So, and I think Charlie, by the way, you know, Mr. Pierce, I think he was underrated this way. You know, it's hard to remember what he was up against as an independent filmmaker working in the South, trying to make movies to self-distribute. The way he started out was he made Legend of Boggy Creek and was peddling it around, literally driving around, showing it himself, kind of setting up deals kind of thing. And then Joy Houck, who ran the Houck Southern Distribution Network of drive-in movie theaters, and it was pretty large throughout Louisiana, Texas, parts of Mississippi, I think, and Arkansas. Pretty large holding of drive-in networks. They could put up 200 or 300 screens, in other words. They approached him, and Charlie told me that Mr. Houck, the old man, offered him $1 million cash on the barrel to buy all rights to the movie, but that he declined it. And, you know, he went on to self-release it after that, and four-walled himself, which, you know, that's why I think a lot of that, although, you know, again, four-walling, I don't know if anybody, such an arcane term, a lot of people know it, but it's just a kind of belabor. A four-wall is where the producer of the film, not the studio or somebody that's got a connection, but the producer will actually go to the theater owners and book the film into the theater themselves, bypassing the studio's involvement. Mel Gibson did it most recently, of course, with The Last Temptation of Christ, in the most successful fashion. That was probably the most successful four-wall in history, actually, now that I think about it. But it's super rare because of the corporate controls today. It was still possible back then, though. And Charlie, to his credit, you know, to $22 million worth of credit, literally, or at least liquidity, I should say, he figured it out. You know, that movie, by the way, didn't just do well in the South. And this is why I think its legacy is important, okay? There is much ample criticism about the picture, from all of the technical deficiencies to all sorts of things. The music causes lots of controversy. All of this is, you know, hey, fair game and whatever. But the film is a historical document. It's one of those rare Southern regional movies that broke out and transcended and became a national phenomenon. And not a lot of Southern regional films, kind of like Romero did with Night of the Living Dead or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, here in Austin. There's a kind of a thing where, you know, these regional films are rare to break out like that and become national phenomena. And Legend of Boggy Creek did, and it's all the more remarkable because it's nothing but gap-toothed locals. Really, a lot of handheld verite photography that's, you know, pretty cheesy at times. And, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a crazy hodgepodge movie. It's almost unaccountable why it was so successful. But the truth of it really is it's probably one of the most successful independent films ever made for its era. And its impact, furthermore, is what's remarkable. The fact that the people who saw it, many of whom, like myself, ended up writing books about it or becoming actual cryptozoologists, is, I really, I mean, sadly, having written a book, and I should have an answer for this, I really can't account for its mystique and its enduring popularity, but it is certainly that, and it's a transcendent classic of films, no matter what genre you label it in or no matter how you think of it. It's very few films ever culturally really ignite a passion in followers that way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know a lot of people are running around acting like Gone with the Wind or even, I mean, you see it in the Star Wars fans, of course. But, you know, what I'm trying to really get at is, like, this is a folklore celebration. It'd be like more people getting into suddenly being Paul Bunyan You know, because in a weird way, the Balk monster was based on local folklore that Charlie grew up with and heard about. And as he claims in the opening of the movie, experienced firsthand when the creature wailed at him when he was, you know, running across the fields as a youth. So, you know, there's all of that kind of, and that's the other last thing I wanted to say about that kind of idea about Charlie. Is I think one of the smart things he did in that film, although it seems real heavy-handed now at times, is that he blended in a lot of things. It's a docudrama, like you said. It's a Disney nature film, you know, like, you know, Sparky's going up into the woods. He doesn't realize up ahead of the bend there's a bobcat. You know, it's, there's all of that in there, too. But then there's all this stark, realistic horror that's really kind of like, yeah, the film was rated G when it was self-rated G when it was released in the theaters. And I think that's another thing, like the fact that it was so intense and scary at times. I believe that was one of the reasons it marked a lot of the kids who saw it. I don't think it was appropriately rated G. I think that would have been a PG-13 by any means in the era. But a lot of films kind of like, especially the four-walled ones like that, could get away with that in those days. You know, they could self-release a movie and make it whatever rating they kind of wanted as long as no one complained, you know? And so I think the film probably, in other words, had a shock value that was really hardcore for kids who really were weaned on the Disney documentaries and weren't used to that kind of, like, or for example, in Legend of Boggy Creek, shock cut to a dead kitten with its eyes frozen open in horror and close-up looking at you. That, when I was in the audience as a kid, that caused revulsions in the audience. I mean, waves of terror, of panic. I vividly remember it. People were recoiling backwards and kind of screaming. And I just don't, you know, I mean, it's probably nostalgia and getting older, but I can't recall movies having that kind of impact and effect very much anymore in our culture. You know, it was a different era, so to speak.
There's a few things, actually, that when I looked at the film leading up to this, that it sort of made me think of different things. And one is that because it has this primitive kind of quality to it, it adds to the quote-unquote realism of it. The other thing that I also thought about with that is, like, you had brought up Chainsaw and how Chainsaw Massacre, it looks so bad that you almost believe it's real because it looks so bad. And then sort of the other element along with that as to how it kind of became a phenomenon, because you have it looks bad and it looks primitive, and then that adds to this mystique of it, makes me remember when I worked at the theater when the Blair Witch Project came out and almost had the same kind of idea where it's like, oh, this has to be real because look how awful it looks.
Nobody would make a movie that looks deliberately that bad. Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, well, obviously the guys in the Blair Witch credit appears, too, for The Legend of Boggy Creek, for that attitude of, like, let's have locals and, you know, let's integrate that handheld sense of it. You know, this is, you know, you're right. I mean, it's hard today. It's hard today with the saturation of, quote, you know, reality TV, which is surely an oxymoron, and all the other reality-based stuff to get a sense of. I mean, you could turn on any channel and watch endless hours of people and forced into cohabitation and miserable, and you get a sense of reality as being dreadful. But in that era, you know, reality was really, the reality-style docudramas and that verite style were really breaking through. You know, people were boxed in. Maybe it was going to be in color. I actually, you know, I like to think of it like that John Carradine Bigfoot movie from 1970 is everything that's wrong with the genre in a lot of ways. It's got a lot of has-been stars. It's really terribly directed and staged. The Bigfoot creatures don't work. They're obviously bad costumes, you know, and it's just dreadful. And it's all very much like a kind of a classic low-budget Hollywood movie. Very staid, very professional, but flatly lit. Everybody's standing around. It feels professional, all right, but dreadfully so. And then you go to Charlie's movie 2 years later, and it's like he's floating around in the bayou. He's getting these low-angle, you know, widescreen shots. And that's the other thing that I really have to emphasize, and this is what killed me about this movie. Charlie went to great lengths to get at least the nature photography in it to look exceptionally good for the area, and it does in its real, you know, Techniscope, widescreen, properly transferred, but that doesn't exist on DVD. No one's ever properly transferred widescreen and, you know, properly restored, as far as I know, at least. And so the movie's never really been seen like the people in the era saw it. I mean, it'd be like seeing somewhat, you know, any classic widescreen film where you see the reduced scope print, and that makes the grain on it really more noticeable, because Charlie used a technique that was really pretty much kind of, you know, a Nouvelle Vogue kind of idea then of this Technoscope. They got it from Leone and the Italians. It was where you could shoot a regular 35mm camera, but the lens would double print two frames on each 35mm frame, and therefore give you, you know, a rectangular image on the top and the bottom, and it was one and then two frames. You know, in other words, you were basically dividing up the 35mm film frame and making it basically two super wide 16mm frames, but 35 wide. But it did have a loss of definition. But it was a popular format because you could use modified 16 cameras or lightweight 35 cameras with those lenses and shoot that. And also, because it put two frames on every one frame of 35, it cut your negative cost in half. You could buy half as much film stock. So for Charlie, that was ingenious, man. He was like, not only will it look great, it's widescreen, but, you know, I won't have to burn off half my budget, which is probably what he did spend on the raw stock he bought for it, you know. And it's, given that he was shooting a lot of docudrama-esque, and I'm sure burning a lot more footage than he was able to use, you know, higher shooting ratio for docudramas kind of typically, you know, then I'm sure the cost was a big factor for him that way. I'm sure every time he rolled it down, he was sweating, you know, just to get it in the can. So I think that was a very smart economical choice for him to use that technique. And that kind of shows you, you know, I mean, his films, you know, getting back to Charlie Pierce a bit, his films are often, you know, criticized for various reasons or whatever, but they often have a very good technical quality that's much more impressive than the budgets would seemingly allow. And I don't believe that's accidental, and because it's too consistent in his work. And he was always a stickler for the cinematography. And you know, even up until the last, he was always talking about, like, he had just bought a digital camera and he was going to go out and shoot a feature. And, you know, he never gave it up, man. Even though he was retired and it really wasn't happening day to day for him, he was still, you know, interested in it. So I think he had a real great, genuine love and passion for cinema that comes through despite maybe the problems of some of his films.
Yeah, that's neat. I've never really heard of that kind of double printing onto the 35. I mean, I remember back really old school where you would take the 16 reel and split it and it would become 8mm, but I had never heard of the 35 to 16 kind of stuff. But yeah, the way that it looks, at least on the copy I've seen, I mean, it looked like it wasn't even 8mm. It looked like 4mm or something. It was just, oh, it was so tough to see and everything. And yeah, I'd love to see a nice copy of it. But it's weird, the way the narrative goes along, it just kind of like, it feels really kind of herky-jerky. I felt like I was in a car being driven by somebody who had never really driven before, because it felt like we're going forward and then we kind of stop and then we go forward again and we kind of stop again. And just, but I have to say, man, the thing that stands out for me the most of that whole film is it's not even the creature itself, it's those damn songs, man. What's going on with the music in this movie?
Okay, when I saw the film, and I saw it repeatedly when it was playing, the 3 days only now playing in my little town, you know, the other thing in the four wall ads for people who are, you know, don't know it or just don't remember it. and this was the key to it as well. You know, you would come into an area like, let's say, somewhere in Michigan, maybe northern Detroit suburb, and you would concentrate on that one area, and you would find the TV station, the UHF TV station in the area with the lowest ad rates that covered the widest margin. And then you would bet on that station by just saturating your ads on it. In other words, instead of spreading your TV ads over 8 channels that might hit most of Detroit, you'd go in and you would say, well, I know that only this part of northern Detroit's going to see this signal, so I'm going to run my ad 4 times an hour instead of once an hour. And that's what Charlie and these guys figured out. By saturating it on one channel, people almost inevitably saw it when they switched around their television dial. And he was a real early forerunner in the success of that idea. You know, that was novel. Believe it or not, then, movies did not, I mean, this is staggering, I'm going to repeat this. Up until Charlie and some other people had success with this formula, motion picture studios did not, as a weekly routine of their exploitation of movies, cut TV ads. It's staggering, but it's true. They looked at television as the absolute enemy, so the last thing they were going to do is pay to have commercials made that advertised on TV. And Charlie and the rest of the guys that were a part of this movement figured out, well, that's just stupid. I mean, since they weren't affiliated with the studios, they could exploit the loophole. And that's why $22 million later, there's a genius about his movie making that, you know, you can really appreciate if you understand what he figured out. And what, it wasn't just him, it was other people too. You know, I noted in the research that people who post and who are fans and then not fans of the movie, particularly people who see it later, often criticize the music, and fairly so. It sticks out and stops the movie narratively, but I really believe that what Charlie was going for in that is something that he wanted to create pathos, and he wasn't going to be able to do it like Boris Karloff with makeup and, you know, he didn't have James Whale's palette, and certainly Karloff wasn't on the set. It was somebody in a bad ape suit, really. And I think what he was trying to do there was to try to figure out a way to make it work, even though he had these incredible limitations. And now, sung in the movie, and I'm going to croon it badly because that's what gives you the cheese factor. This is how it goes, just a couple lines in the movie with this kind of lilting Joan Baez folk ballad, slightly melancholic, you know, da-na-na-na-na-na-na. It's really kind of pretty music, really. But then the song lyrics go, Here the sulfur river flows, rising when the storm cloud blows. This is where the creature goes, lurking in the land he knows. In my terrible singing aside, the next part of it goes like this, and I'm going to read it, because that sets the tone of how it sounded. Perhaps he dimly wonders why, is there no other such as I, to love, to touch before I die, to listen to my lonely cry. You know, you strip that out, all he is a boggy creek monster. He's just savage Sasquatch. What's interesting to me about it, even though by modern standards these lyrics and the music don't work, they're just too on the nose. We'd say too melodramatic or, you know, just cheesy, whatever. I think if you listen to the lyrics, and I think in the era, the audience, this was a very popular musical style. Folk music ruled then, you know. And so I think this style of music was much more palatable to people. And as a result, I don't think that they were taken out of it. I think they were transported by it. And I think the lyrics are actually very poetic. I mean, they may be, you know, they may be cheesy, as everybody says, but I think they actually capture the kind of aspect about, well, wait a minute, what would it be like to be the last Mohican? And that's another, you know, motif that gets worked into the Bigfoot genres. What would it be like to be the last lonely humanoid, you know? And there's a tragic quality about that that I think that the music really is trying to get at. And, you know, I mean, then there's the other song that's really notoriously in the movie about Travis Crabtree. And there's this, like, you know, loving ballad about, you know, where Travis is going down the creek and it's, hey, Travis Crabtree. And it's really kind of, I mean, it's almost like hee-haw level at some level. But then again, it's authentic, too. And I think that in the era, it worked because the audiences felt it added the authenticity of culture that they were finding really interesting about the movie. Look, to say one last thing about that before I say something about the narration, I grew up watching movies where all Southerners were portrayed like, it was kind of hee-haw time, or, you know, it was the Jim Deal Southerner, but it never seemed reality-based. And the poverty that I saw that was widespread was always glorified in the Hollywood movies. They always, you know, the shacks always looked like art-directed shacks. It was always a little Abner, man. It was always nothing I could relate to. None of the actors had authentic accents. I mean, it just didn't seem real. In this movie, to me, you know, growing up in Mississippi, on the border states up there in that area, and in a very similar kind of dense, piney woods region, this movie to me seemed like it had been made in my hometown, and these are like the kind of people I would run into. So, as I say in the book, it kind of broke the fourth wall for me. I think for a lot of people who grew up in small towns, no matter where they were, if they were small town, rural adjacent, I think this movie had a big, big impact on them because it was the boogeyman in your backyard rather than, I mean, let's face it, Dracula, you know, Wolfman, all this stuff seems very European or distant to American kids, I think, or at least it used to in that era. It all seemed kind of faintly quaint, Bela Lugosi and all. It hadn't, even the Hammer stuff seemed European to me. What was interesting about this movie is, man, it was right in my backyard. And literally, you know, it was something that if I go out at night to take the trash out, I better think about.
Yeah, that was before all those damn vampires moved into the Pacific Northwest.
Well, before vampire culture took over and became its own thing. I mean, that's the other thing you have to remember. We're talking about a movie that's made in 1972. You know, that's a long time ago, and a lot of cultures changed, and I don't think, you know, and, you know, that's why the movie you know, I like to think of it like there's movies that transcend their era and people always watch over and over again, and then there's movies that are kind of like of their era and they watch because it reminds them of that era more. And I think Charlie's movie is more like the latter, where it doesn't really transcend its era too well because you have to qualify and quantify why it works. But once you set up the stage, it still works pretty well. So I think it's a good example of its era. And even though, like, Easy Rider, it seems almost outrageously campy at times because it's so much of its era, it really is reflective that way. And the fact that he made it outside of the studio system and on his own terms, I mean, Jesus, the guy was like a Southern John Cassavetes. Even if he wasn't making, you know, intense human dramas, he really was doing it all, man, writing it, editing it, shooting it, you know. And he wasn't narrating it, because I did want to, you know, mention that. The guy who narrated it is great, and I think that he's another reason the movie works. His name was Vern Stearman, and he was a weatherman in Texas, Texarkana, Shreveport area, on an NBC affiliate. And Charlie got to know him and liked his voice, evidently, from hearing him, and so asked him to do the narration on The Legend of Boggy Creek, and he also did The Town That Dreaded Sundown, which is why there's kind of a continuity there. And as a kind of a trivial kind of note, he also did the narration on The Being, you know, that cult movie. So he's got three credits, actually. But I always thought, up until recently, that, you know, in doing the book, I always thought that Charlie was the narrator, because Vern plays Charlie narrating it. He saw, you know, when you hear the narrator speak in Legend of Boggy Creek, he says, "I remember when I was doing this." And so I always just assumed that really was, you know, Charlie Pierce. But it turns out, you know, that he actually had a kind of a stand-in narrator for himself, as it turns out.
You talk about it being of its era, which is interesting because, you know, granted, hairstyles change, things like that happen. And as I was watching it, I kept waiting for one of two things to happen. Either for Leatherface to show up or Harry Reams, because at times it could be horror, it could be porno. It's just the way it's shot.
Well, yeah, you know, it's ground out. It's natural lighting, a lot of it, or it's like one or two photo floods. I mean, some of the lighting in the interior scenes are so garish that they feel like Kodachrome home movies. And I actually believe that, like Blair Witch and like other movies that have, like the original Evil Dead, sometimes movies can be so transgressively bad formally that they make the audience suddenly suspend its disbelief because they don't know how to predict what's going to happen. I believe that that is often a disaster because it means they're just going to start laughing and give up on it. They don't know what's going to happen. My experience in the film business and making films and writing them and writing about them is that, you know, you guide the audience at whatever level. So, but these films that are trying to guide the audience, like you say, that film felt like you were in a car being driven by someone who'd never driven it. Yeah, exactly. And so what do you expect? Well, you expect to hope to get out alive, and you're going to be terrified, and there's going to be turns, and what the, you know, is going to happen? And I think that's exactly what kind of works about that kind of movie, and why those kind of qualities, you know, are hard to emulate again these days. You know, they, you have to break through the actual look of a time and a period to kind of get that effect, that shock effect, that porno effect. I mean, yeah, there's a. I think that's a really good thing, because I think that those films of that era often felt illicit. Like, you know, you weren't supposed to be seeing it, so it was like a peep show, grindhouse kind of aesthetic that permeated all those movies that made them tawdry in and of themselves. Forget what they were about. It was just the, you could tell they weren't professionally made at a big studio, right? So there was always a kind of a, at least I thought as a kid and teen, and when I was getting into these movies, that that's what I liked about them, is they seem unhinged.
Well, Dave, how you holding up out there? You still wandering around in the woods?
Yeah, but, and I got to tell you, man, it's a lot darker here in Michigan than it is in the Texas woods where I'm used to holding fort, man. Maybe you need to set up another one of those flares.
I think that's what we're going to do. While we take a break, we're going to go try and see if we can find Dave again. We'll play some important messages. We'll be right back with more on The Legend of Boggy Creek here on the Projection Booth.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Some roads are better left untraveled. It follows .net.
We interrupt your podcastual programming for this HollywoodLeak.com news break. Here's the latest from HollywoodLeak.com. Own network tanking. Oprah wants her cars back. Sealed Rose Mustache changes his name to Walrus. And a quick pilot casting update. You didn't get it. Entertainment news is always leaking. For these stories and more, go to HollywoodLeak.com.
That's it. That's the last one. The last flare we got.
Oh, man. We're back. Dave, we just set up the last flare. Did you get a chance to see that, over on the walkie-talkie there, sir?
I think that's Venus, man. That's not the flare.
Dave, you're 53 miles west of Venus. Whichever way you're heading, just turn around and start back the other way. And while you're walking, tell us more about the book. Why Bigfoot? Was it pretty much directly related to Boggy Creek, or were there other things that kind of pushed you over the edge with this?
Well, about the book, to talk about something to get my mind off this, because while you're loading the next flare, it's funny because like now I'm starting to remember why, which is like when I was a kid, I would hear local stories about people out in the woods like I am right now, stupidly realizing how dumb I am, and running into Bigfoot, you know, and they would come back and tell me these stories, and I was like, yeah, okay, either they're totally mad or, you know, and it was easy to believe that in the daylight, but right now I can kind of understand that there's a kind of a logic to it anyway. I grew up with the culture of Bigfoot. I mean, it was like I would go to the newsstands and the Argosy magazines were always like Sasquatch on the cover, you know, like I just want to reproduce in the book where he's battling a grizzly bear. You know, I always liked that one in particular. It kind of, you know, elevated it to like that War of the Gargantuas kind of thing, you know, where Bigfoot was taking him on. So I grew up with that whole culture of it, and it was in a $6 million man was another big one. You know, it kind of seemed to always come back in waves. Back then, I mean, now Bigfoot and Bigfoot movies are constant. You know, they're always a new one. There's a new television commercial, whatever. But back then, it was more sporadic, and you know, you couldn't, of course, record to VCR, and so a lot of it depended more on being able to, you know, kind of follow it along. It was much more like sports in a way back then. You know, where you went to the game, or you tried to follow it on the radio and listen to it. It was the same with movies and these kind of ephemeral TV shows. Like, you know, couldn't wait to watch In Search Of, because it might be an episode about Bigfoot. But even if not, it would be like a little picture of the Roger Patterson Bigfoot costume, or actual Bigfoot, depending on your point of view, in the beginning of, or the end credits of the show. I can't remember which, but, you know, so it was ubiquitous for me, and I was always, like, fascinated by it because of the fact that it was something I could locally experience. I had really vivid fears as a kid, you know, of, like, having an encounter with Bigfoot that were irrational, and I knew that they were irrational, but yet I couldn't get around them. I wouldn't sleep near an open window because I had a fear from this movie in particular where a large hairy arm is thrusting through the windows constantly. Like, one guy's on the bathroom in Legend of Boggy Creek, but then there's windows, and there's a kind of a sense of, you know, pervasive threat about it. It's not in a lot of Bigfoot movies, Legend of Boggy Creek. And that's another thing that's interesting about that movie, is it kind of really kind of makes Bigfoot or skunk apes or whatever you want to call them, it kind of makes them much more sinister in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, they're roaming around and attacking. So that's kind of how I got into it. It felt like a real threat as a kid, a real mortal danger. And, you know, I lived in a rural area, so I could relate to it, whereas, you know, again, some of the other fantasy monsters, that Frankenstein and things, didn't seem that much of a threat to me. They were fantasy ideas. Bigfoot seemed real to me, and, of course, you know, to a lot of people, he really is real. So it's not even like my fears based on a movie image that's then been turned into folklore. It's just the other way around. Popular folklore and reported sightings support the evidence for a creature worldwide, and the movies kind of caught up to it, which is interesting, because that usually movies are quick to exploit, but in this case they were slower to exploit, you know.
If you had to pick like five of the key films in the whole Cine de Sasquatch, as you call it, what would they be?
You know what, that's like asking someone what, like, what's the best way to be baptized? It's always going to lead to an argument, but an interesting one too. You know, I mean, I kind of look at it, okay, from a longer view as a, you know, like, wow, I'm a fan of the genre. So I look at the one of the top ones, number one would be, and this is not particularly in order of like number one and then number two. It's just more of like, you know, five gentle ones, is definitely Half Human. You know, that was a Toho effort that was, you know, impactful because of the way it depicts the Yeti as almost like Bigfoot-like in that film, too. Dark furred and much more menacing, much more of a threat, a visceral threat. So that movie, like, for Lauren Coleman and a lot of people of that era, really established this idea of a threatening hominid, you know, in their minds, and their subconscious psyche took hold, and look what, you know, I mean, they became real-life believers and followers and cryptozoologists. So that movie's big for that reason. And then it's hard to see in its pure form because it contains images of native Japanese citizens in the north who are they're Caucasian in descent, and so the treatment and depiction is considered somewhat racist, offensive, like Song of the South is in the United States by Disney. And so the film has never been properly released in the United States in the version that, you know, Honda directed that should be properly seen. I've seen a bootleg of that, made off what looks like a bad 16mm Toho or Japanese TV station or something. Seriously, the bootleg, it's really crude, but at least you can get the widescreen and you can get a sense of it that way. So that one I would recommend is one. The one that's easily available, and also personally I think is a great one, is The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, 1957 from Hammer. It's stage-bound, and it's very much of a medium to low-budget Hammer level. But what I really like about it is the screenplay by Nigel Neal and this kind of taut sense of, you know, rational behavior. It's like Curse of the Demon, where skepticism and rationalism are put up against beliefs that challenge it. And some of the most likable characters are skeptics, and, you know, like in Curse of the Demon, Dana Andrews plays a skeptic and a debunker, and he goes up against a supernatural force that proves to be real beyond his ability to rationalize away. I like that idea. I'm not necessarily a believer per se one way or the other in that, but I like that idea of where rationalism ends, you know, the creature, Bigfoot, begins, because in a weird way, that's kind of what it's like. And that movie really gets at that. It gets at the isolation of the Himalayas. And it also introduces a concept that I think is really unexplored somewhat in the Bigfoot genre, which is psychic Bigfoot. I mean, one of the things the screenplay suggests is that the reason the creatures are able to basically remain aloof from mankind and stuff is that they can read humans' minds easily and transmit deceptive thoughts to them and make them go awry so that they're never detectable. And it's like that old Chinese proverb, what's the most dangerous animal in the forest? The one you never see, you know? And I kind of like that. I think there's a kind of a nice quality of the writing of that particular picture. And anyway, it holds up pretty well, too, if you can see the widescreen DVD version. I think Anchor Bay put it out. I think Legend of Boggy Creek, for all the reasons we've covered, because it just transformed so many people. You know, once I get beyond those three, I can think of lots of others, like Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot, directed by this guy named Ed Ragazzino. It's another big one like Legend of Boggy Creek that a lot of kids saw. It was four-walled. You know, it was put out by National Enterprises, American Enterprises, who, you know, were Salt Lake-based four-wallers, kind of like a forerunner of Sun Chick, you know. And so it's got a lot of pedigree and interesting exploitation stuff in it. You know, beyond that, I start thinking about how each film, because this is the way I look at it, you know, my own dry way, I kind of start looking at how each film influences the genre more than maybe stands out as an example of it. But, man, there's so many good examples of different films that you can cite, both, you know, the more recent ones and the older ones. I have a hard time answering that question per se, but I think those are three that I would recommend for sure. The fourth, Sasquatch, Legend of Bigfoot. Now, beyond that, I start saying, you know, you probably, if you like any of those movies, you're probably going to find others in the genre you like. If you don't, you probably want to move on to, you know, gothic horrors or whatever, you know.
So the Meatloaf Yeti film is not one of your top ones?
Well, I'm not a believer. Okay, so here's the thing. Harry and the Hendersons didn't work for me. I was too old. By the time it came out, it was amusing and had some moments and all. But, I mean, it didn't move me. But then the guy who directed, Timothy Scuzzo, who directed the Sasquatch Dumpling Gang, also called the Sasquatch Gang in the United States. Yeah, and I interviewed him in the book. You know, that's one of his big films, Harry and the Hendersons. You know, that really, and another guy, too. I mean, so you kind of see how, like, every now and again, these Bigfoot movies come along that a whole young generation, it tends to be younger people, formatively kind of grab onto. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. It's a public domain character. You know, it's not Stan Lee's Bigfoot. So that part of it, again, is really remarkable. Part of the reason why I think it's, so the films are so popular, even though many of them are so bad, is that I think the folklore love of the character, whether it's real or not, the folklore lore love of Bigfoot is real, and it's worldwide. And so I think people bring those good feelings to it despite the bad films because they like that character. He's popular. I mean, he's a beloved character, and that's what's interesting about it to me is that folklore where you have a beloved character is really unusual.
You talk about some of them being really bad. What do you think are the elements that make a really good Sasquatch film?
I'll tell you what I believe, after having watched so many of them now, what makes them interesting is if people kind of understand that we've all seen bad Bigfoot movies. And, you know, to be honest, some of the better ones I've seen, like Not Your Typical Bigfoot Movie, this documentary, absolutely, I mean, look at the title, Not Your Typical Bigfoot Movie. I mean, the title alone tells you they're aware of how bad most of them really are. And that is an actually very good documentary, by the way, about a couple of guys in Ohio who are from a small town that got shut down, you know, steel mills, car industry, everything else. And they're just, I don't know if you've seen it, it's really, really good. They're just trying to get by, and they put a lot of their energies into Bigfoot research, kind of because you get the sense that it's just something to do because they're so bored and they're chronically unemployed. One of them's got emphysema, the older gentleman. And then they get involved with Tom Biscardi, a real-life Bigfoot researcher who's much more known for being basically the Carl Denham figure in real life, staged multiple hoaxes and, you know, took money on coast-to-coast AM radio broadcast promising to show people a Bigfoot being found in the forest on a video feed and, you know, all that kind of stuff, the Georgia Bigfoot hoax. And he gets involved with them, and he kind of breaks up their friendship, and the movie's there to document it all. And it's really kind of moving because you're these two lifelong friends, and here's this Carl Denham type, and he comes in and he quickly separates them and turns one against the other, and he really manipulates them and puts them through the ringer, and they're so awed and wowed, you know, here's our hero, and he's here, and we kind of do what he says, and so they just go along, and they play along, and they get hurt and used by it. And then by the end of the film, you know, they've kind of gotten over Biscardi, realized he was a jerk, and they've moved on. They repair their relationship. Hey, that's a pretty good movie. And it's real life. And, you know, it doesn't really say you have to believe in Bigfoot. You can make fun of Dwayne and the other character in the movie who really believe in research. But you can also see that, like all people who are looking for anything spiritual, these people are not looking for Bigfoot often only to find the cryptozoological specimen. They're looking for something much deeper. And this movie really captures it pretty well, I think. Not your typical Bigfoot movie. So that's another one maybe I would recommend for some of the younger genre versions that have come out, you know, the more recent examples.
Let's talk a little bit about the sequels. I mean, we talked about the original Legend of Boggy Creek, but then I have to say I was a little confused when I'm looking around and I see, like, Boggy Creek 2 show up, and which they did on Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah.
So watch that, and because they've got it up at, like, you know, 10 different parts or something on YouTube, so that was a pretty good way to watch it. But what's going on? Because there's other Boggy Creeks that are out there. What's the story with all the Boggy Creek movies?
Well, Charlie Pierce told me about that, and I've never verified this, so I go on record as saying this is what he told me. So, again, I don't know. Is that he had a falling out with some Dallas investors or something that produced the sequel, and at one point he just walked away from it. I think they paid him off. And then they kept on working on it. And I do know that if you watch the movie, the second one, which is Return to Boggy Creek, with Don Wells and Dana Plato in it, it's got a number of producers listed. I mean, these days, you can see 20 producers on a Transformers movie, and it's nothing. But back then, to see more than a couple of producers was really remarkable. And so it indicates the movie was problematic and that they probably had to keep selling off rights to get more producers to put money in and that kind of thing. And the movie wasn't very successful. You know, I think Charlie knew what had happened to his gold mine. Is that was the impression he gave me. He was outraged that they'd basically taken a leak in Boggy Creek. And he wanted to kind of try to restore it. So he did The Barbaric Beast of Boggy Creek, a.k.a. Boggy Creek 2, a.k.a., you know, lots of other titles because it was sold to video under different formats and deals. And, you know, and that movie is very flawed, too, in a lot of ways. In a weird way, it's no more better or worse than the second Boggy Creek movie. The sequels were disappointing by all accounts. Though, you know, I would say that both have qualities in them that are worthwhile to look at if you're a big fan of the genre. But if you're a casual viewer, they'll both disappoint for sure, I think. They're very much miscalculated movies, unfortunately. You know, particularly the one Charlie made, the third one, Boggy Creek 2, if you will, it's disappointing to see it become such a routine kind of movie. But I don't know. You know, I mean, how many times can you go back to the creek, so to speak, before you get bogged down in it? I mean, it's a hard genre, and I do believe that a lot of the success of the film, as we've discussed here, is not really based in the movie itself, but a kind of a cultural zeitgeist where, you know, certain movies like Blair Witch, you know, they transcend and they become a phenomena for a while, and this was one of those things.
I want to ask about the kind of the nitty gritty of the book, because I mean, for folks listening, you know, when we finally put this episode out there, I mean, this book, I mean, well, first off, it's huge, like as far as the actual dimensions of the book, and it's thick, and you go.
Hey, wait a minute,
through,
Mike, did you say dementia or dimensions of the book?
The actual physical dimensions, yeah, but there is a little bit of dementia in here because. I mean, you are obsessive. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I eat with a spoon. I mean, you go through not just the movies, but you've got, yeah. You know, every kind of, I won't say you go into like the print media, but you definitely have every sort of visual moving media. You've got cartoons, TV shows, commercials. I mean, it's an exhaustive look at all of these things. And you kind of, I like the way that you kind of skirt the line too, where you've got is it a Yeti, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Skunk Ape, but then you also have like the, you know, this might be a guy who's kind of looks more like a monkey, you know, a guy in an ape costume. You know, you've got Trog in there, you've got 2001, you've got Chewbacca, you know, so it's like, you know, trying to just get all of these things, and, you know, Tanya's Island. I mean, Tanya's Island is I'm a huge Tanya's Island fan, so it was great to see that. It was great how you kind of brought all of those things under this umbrella. I've got two questions for you. First off is, How long did it take from the day that you said, I should write this book, to, you know, actually getting it out there? And then the other one is, what were the movies that you're trying to find? I mean, because like I said, this is exhaustive, and it was probably exhausting, but what were the ones that you couldn't find that were still out there, your white whales, as it were?
Two more really good questions. And one question I have back is about the flares, but it's cool. I'm calmed. When we're talking about something I like, I'm calmed. This, I don't know, man. I keep getting a whiff of an odor, and I don't think it's me, but it could be. Anyway,
you might be getting closer to camp. I mean, Rob's had a lot of hot dogs tonight. So,
hey, buddy, can you lay down a suppressing line of fire to help me get back to camp? I'll take anything I can find. It's dark, and it's just my imagination, but I keep thinking when I stop, I hear footsteps a few seconds behind me.
It was just that, I'm sorry, it was the beans. Blazing Saddles. I'm sorry.
Are you guys pranking me for real? I mean, with the footsteps thing, or what's that like?
No, we are still sitting here by the campfire, so there's no.
I just got the nerves. I got the nerves. Anyway, I wrote a fanzine called Remote Jockey Digest. Mike, we actually exchanged zines, and I reviewed yours in maybe that issue that I had the Bigfoot article in. But I wrote an article called The Cinema of Bigfoot, or Bigfoot Cinema, for that issue of my zine. And it got such a response like no other article I ever wrote, which is really surprising to me. I got, like, you know, email from people, and people mentioned it to me. And I, at that point, you know, I was like, wow, that might be a good idea for another article, like maybe Famous Monsters or some bigger monster magazine or something, you know. But not, I didn't really think about it too much. And then years later, a friend of mine was over, and he was mentioning it to me. He goes, you know, nobody's ever written a book about that. You should do it. And just kind of like a light went off in my head. I said, you know, that's an interesting idea. And that was back in like early, maybe 2000 or so, that my friend said that. But I didn't seriously pursue it for many, many years later, 8 or 9 years later. And then at some point I just decided that I kind of got frustrated in one weird way that it wasn't there for me to read. I kind of was interested in it, and I noticed that as I corresponded with lots of real-world cryptozoologists and stuff prior to deciding to write it, that there was a kind of a need, because they were all interested in it. They were all like, well, we could sure use it. And then I noticed that even, like, people in the film community, the B-movie community, were... You'd see posts about Legend of Boggy Creek or another movie, and there'd be mentions, but there never was any connective thread to it. It was always isolated, like, yeah, here's a Bigfoot movie, you know, and or here's a Bigfoot or Yeti film. But they never had any, like, yeah, it's a part of an overall bigger thing. And I always felt like it just, I mean, you know, whether you agree with it or not, I write in the book, you can say that genre classification is the ultimate indulgence, and certainly a lot of times you can... you know, find examples that disprove everything that I'm saying tonight or whatever. But what's interesting is that there's so much of it falls in line with it, too, when you look at it. You know, it's really there. There's a there. I kind of say it's like, you know, film noir movies. They're, you know, they really do. None of those filmmakers, and I knew some of them from film school and all, and that were teaching me later in their careers, they weren't, you know, on the sets going, let's see, how do we create existential gloom, and we want to make sure the cross shadows are just right, and, you know, here comes the femme fatale. They weren't talking like that. They were just making movies and grinding them out, and they had shared influences like the crime pulp novels and lots of other ones. But, you know, my point is, was that, you know, if you look at film noirs, they're distinctive, and, I mean, it's true for Bigfoot cinema as well. You know, it's really distinctive, and it really does have this weird kind of quality about it that way. So I guess I spent about, you know, off and on 3 years researching and writing it, but really about a year and a half, 2 years solid writing research. And over that time, I contacted a lot of people in the field, and I tried to get perspectives that were different. And I didn't want it to be a believer book, because I'm not a believer per se. I say to people I'm Sasquatch agnostic, which is that I don't have a belief one way or the other per se. I don't find a need to. I'm more interested in the way people perceive the Sasquatch idea, you know, on larger and smaller personal scales. To me, that's what's interesting. That's just my thing, you know, what I get off on it. So I noticed, and when I started talking to a lot of the experts, real-life believers, and fans of the movies, that a lot of them had made lists of movies that they knew about, and they would always be 10 or 12 movies, and a lot of them were, you know, movies I'd come across by the end of the research. But sometimes I'd find new ones, and I'd contact them and say, what's this movie about? And they would say, yeah, I have a copy of it on DVD-R that I got from a one-time screening in Quebec at 4 a.m. in 1979 kind of thing, you know? And You know, and it was like, and some of the films are so rare and so hard to see. And I tried to say in the book, I couldn't find some of them. You know, one of them in particular is called Rufus J. Pickle and the Indian, or The Return of Bigfoot. And it had Rory Calhoun in it, and it was made by some of the people that helped Clinton get elected and were from the Arkansas area and went on to do television sitcoms that were very well, you know, well received and well known. And the producer did the Man from Hope election campaign spot that many people attribute to helping Clinton get elected. So these are very powerful people, but back in the day, this producer was, and director was, you know, doing a movie with Bigfoot in it. And what's interesting is that the movie doesn't exist, really. And I tried to contact their office, and I got no response. There's no VHS copy of it. People who've been in the movie remembered it, posted it on the internet, and I've actually gotten a letter from a gentleman who claims that he's a Rory Calhoun completist, and he's been researching every Rory Calhoun movie that he can find. And this one is in particular interest to him because he said he read my book, and he said, thanks for the information. Here's some things I can share with you. And, for example, he told me that there's some conspiracy talk in the town where it was shot in Arkansas that the reason the film isn't released is because there's a young Bill Clinton in it. And it's not maybe a flattering scene, and or it's just an embarrassment. And whether or not it's true or not, what I find really interesting is just like the Bigfoot thing with Patterson and the Zapruder film. There's this, you know, people, okay, if it is true, then the Clintons don't want a Bigfoot movie to be seen that Bill Clinton or Roger or someone is in. And if it isn't true, people feel the need to kind of graft the Clintons onto this folklore about Bigfoot, and somehow now there's a Bigfoot-Clinton connection that's, you know, I mean, I don't know. You can't prove or disprove it at this point. The gentleman gave me the information he had about it, but I guess it's interesting to me that way. I don't consider it a sociologist's point of view. That's way too academic, but I do look at it like I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell's, and he's a huge influence on my way of looking at movies. And I mean, I'm not novel, of course. George Lucas and many others have done this before, but I mean, I guess what I say is that in particular for Bigfoot, Joseph Campbell made a lot of sense to me. And why is this image all around the world in almost every known culture, in almost every known variations, always comes down to the same kind of sets of ideas, and why does that permeate all the films that way? And when you start looking at it that way, it becomes a kind of an interesting part of the human experience that's way, I guess, bigger than even the movies and the stories. It's kind of universal, and I wish I could give you some, you know, real erudite answer as to why. I wrote the whole book trying to purge myself and get to why is it, and I still really couldn't give you a succinct answer, except that I can document in the book all the different viewpoints about Bigfoot that people bring to the subject matter, from, you know, passionate believers to literally there's a creationist who works in Bigfoot into God's plan about mythologies of creationism to, you know, I can go the gamut. And as you note in the book, I kind of somewhat do. One last thing about the commercials and why I kind of go out on that level is, I do believe that the commercials are really just little mini movies in a lot of ways. I like what Kubrick said about that, which is, if you can make 30 seconds work that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, you made a great movie. Yeah, it's only 30 seconds, but, you know, I mean, you did a lot. If you can introduce a conflict and resolve it, and it sells the product, you know, I don't see too many ads like that anymore. So I kind of think of these, like, beef jerky things as little mini movies, and I think that that's the way they're marketed, too. They're marketed as, like, little interstitial movies you would see, like little, you know, serials almost. They seem almost larger than just a commercial in a way. And I guess because they're serial in nature and they add up, I look at them that way too.
Well, Dave, since you're wandering around in the woods there, folks may never get to meet you to get an autographed copy of the book. But at least if they want one, where can they get it?
Well, I have a website for it called the BigfootFilmography.com, BigfootFilmography.com, and it's just, you know, I mean, check it out there. There's an excerpt you can click over to Amazon to order it, or actually, you know, something I encourage people to do is there's a link there of independent bookstores, a lot of them in your area. You know, search down, you can find it by state, type in your zip code, and anybody that's stocking it at your local bookstore will send it to you, just like Amazon, and, you know, you're keeping your money in your local bookstore, independent economy then, if you feel like it. But if not, you know, order it from Amazon or whomever, and you can see excerpts there. There's also clips from some of the movies and stills and things on the website that kind of show, you know, what the book is about a little bit more. Because like you said, It also makes a great personal flotation device in any flood emergencies I've found. It's large enough to support your family, and it's a massive tome, isn't it? You know, it's funny you said obsessive. I think that's the key word, not only about me writing it, but I think about a lot of Bigfoot fans and film fans of Bigfoot films. I think there's an obsessive quality to it that's definitely, you know, way more prevalent. I guess it's kind of like Star Trek or Star Wars or any other kind of, you know, real hardcore believer-based community. There, it becomes like when you get down into it and you start looking at it, it seems obsessive, and it is. And, yeah, I'm definitely a part of that long tradition of obsessive Bigfoot film fans.
How are you holding up out there? Can you even see the fire through the woods, or what's going on?
I see two fires. They're about... Well, wait a minute. That's not... It must be like an owl's eyes or something reflecting, right? I lit my lighter to try to see where I am, and I saw something. I thought maybe that was... Are you... Yeah. I can't talk right now.
All right, well, this sounds like a great take to...
Guys, I don't want to put it on mute, but...
Rob, why don't we go ahead and we'll play a preview for next week's show.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. This can't be real. This has got to be a joke.
Alex Furlong is about to die. And enter the year 2009, where immortality is only a heartbeat away, where money can buy anything.
Shouldn't you consider an alternative body? Sorry to deceive you.
Including life itself.
Why me? Why don't they just grab somebody who's alive now?
Take a look at these people, Alex. They've lived half their lives with no ozone layer.
Tell me who's behind all this.
I'm sorry. But I can't tell you that.
Alex, don't you remember me?
He died, Jewel. Someone paid to bring him back.
I watched you die.
Welcome to my mind. Don't resist.
Lose your mind, and you can live forever. Free Jack.
It is regarded as the highest quality audio of the creature ever captured.
Jack, so come back and we'll be talking about that, where we'll be blasted into the future, or maybe it was a few years ago, I don't know. We'll definitely be out of the woods with the movie Apocalypse host Fred Fritz next week, and we'll be in the studio, so there's no chance of losing another co-host. Right, Dave? Dave?
I really gotta keep this quiet, man. Alright, listen. And I'm not kidding. Okay. You guys got awesome.
Huh. You still there, Dave? Sounds like he might have gone out of radio range. Let's hope he finds his way back, because it's time for s'mores. Yay!
Hey, hey.
Oh, man. Was that your stomach? Man, thanks again for listening, folks. Be sure to stop by the website for more goodies, including a link to the full feature of Legend of Boggy Creek. You can come on by the website. That's www.projection-booth.com. Man, you are hungry.
This is where the story plays, a world on which we seldom gaze, page from the book of yesterdays, birds and beasts and wind and water, here beneath the bright blue sky, no man's smoke blinds the eagle's eye, and things that crawl or swim or fly, feed and breed and live and die.
Trying to figure out the Sasquatch riddle. Then they figured out it was a missing link. In search of Sasquatch, that was a kick-ass in search of, with Leonard Nimoy kicking out the jams. He captured imaginations of people all around the globe. His name was Sasquatch, so I'm told. Legends ancient in the ancient scribe of the Indian tribe, Apache tribe.
Scientists have proven that the Sasquatch is real. Take a look at the plaster cast of his foot, now you know he's real.
Listen real close to the audio tape, not human, now you know he's real. Couldn't be a man in gorilla suit, no fucking way, now you know he's real. Real,
real, real, real, real, real, real, really real, real.
Don't take this personally, because it's not about your playing.
No, dude, your drumming is kick-ass. It's just that the D, it's always just been me and KG.
And we're just not comfortable being a power trio.
I hope there's no hard feelings.
Sasquatch, we know your legend's dream.
and Tenacious D are...